On March 29th, Pelham police responded to a call about a man fighting with family. As a cruiser pulls up to the scene, dashboard camera video shows Christopher Lanzillo in the street. There's snow on the ground. Lanzillo is broad-shouldered with no shirt on. He's holding a knife.
Drop the knife! Put the knife down!
Family members are just up the driveway. Children are leaving school up the road. Lanzillo is drunk. Officer Brian Kelly, the first cop on scene, says what makes the scenario even more dangerous is what Lanzillo was shouting at police.
What he said several times to me was, "Shoot me. I'm begging you to shoot me. Please shoot me.
Drop it now!
I'm begging you to
drop it now!"
All that tells me is that he's in a pretty desperate situation in his own mind. He's feeling like there's no other options that he has, so it sounds to me like he's not going to give us any options.
Show me either one of you.
Drop the knife! Drop the knife!
So this type of scene, an armed man who's intoxicated and in a desperate mental state, this plays out year after year in New Hampshire. Jeff Strelzin, chief of the homicide unit at the Department of Justice, says these moments are often the result of years of trauma, family breakdown, and unchecked mental illness. But cops don't always know those stories when they arrive on scene. The best police can do is train for an inevitable encounter with a person who isn't behaving rationally.
In these situations, it's become the absolute worst. So it's reached a terrible endpoint, meaning that these officers are way downstream of this problem.
According to public records reviewed by NHPR, drugs and mental illness play an outsized role in police shootings in New Hampshire. Over the past two decades, law enforcement used deadly force 46 times. A little less than half of those incidents were fatal. Mental illness played a role in about a third of the cases, and more than half of the victims were intoxicated. Alcohol, crack, opioids. Most of the victims were armed.
Drop the knife!
No!
New Hampshire police are trained...
In Claremont, an alleged racially motivated incident between teenagers and a young biracial boy in town has rocked the community over the past several weeks. The victim's family says it's an open-and-shut case of racism. The teenager's family says the kids were playing with a rope and climbing trees when things went tragically wrong. The incident has also divided the community as a whole. Some say it points to racism in the area. Others say that's blowing things out of proportion. NHPR's Breida Green reports.
Daddy Pop's Tumble In Diner in Claremont is one of those metal-sided diner cars straight out of the 1940s. Inside, Fallon Carter, the owner's daughter, is talking about the alleged attack with her mom and a friend. They're sitting on the other side of the counter as she works, the vent fan over the griddle on full blast.
He just so happened to be of a different origin. Like, I mean, we're all Americans here. We're all from a different area of the world.
Carter says she doesn't know what the motivation was, but it's probably just bullying. That is a problem here. Her friend, Natalie Jarvis, jumps
in. That was my point, that if that hadn't been the method of the bullying, then this wouldn't have been probably interpreted and blown up this way as a racist thing.
Race, owner Deborah Kirby adds, is not an issue in Claremont. After all, the city is more than 95% white.
Other than there are people that are like, so-called, that I don't know, skinheads or what, supremacists, whatever, and you'll see swastika tattoos and stuff. Yeah, and I don't even see them really bothering anybody. I think because we're not inner city, we're still out in the boonies, kinda. So in this area, I don't find that racism is a problem.
I've heard this perspective a fair amount over the past several weeks. And at the city level, while the city manager...
Lori Leisure likes to think she's the kind of parent who's engaged in what's happening at her daughter's school. Which is why, when scrolling through Facebook last month, she was so surprised to learn about a sexual assault that happened at Manchester West High School in 2015.
My first reaction was... wait a minute, you've known for 2 years, and my daughter was a freshman at the same time this girl was a freshman.
A 14-year-old student was raped by an older student in a secluded hallway during school hours.
It's really shocking that this could have happened in a high school in a hallway. I mean, this is a violent crime.
Even more troubling, she said, was the fact that parents like her had no idea anything like this happened at their child's school, because the school never told them. But as far as state law is concerned, the school didn't have to.
The statute is silent as to any obligation to report to the public or to the parents of the school community.
Diana Fenton, an attorney for the Department of Education, says state law requires districts to notify police of violent incidents within 2 days. But sending letters home to parents, making an announcement, is up to each individual district.
This area of the law is very complicated, and there are various laws that govern.
I find Michael Treadwell in the back of a courtroom. He's wearing a windbreaker and work boots and leaning his elbows on his knees. At first, it looks like he's chewing gum. Later, when we talk, I discover he isn't chewing gum, he's chewing his own gums. Michael Treadwell doesn't have teeth.
When you live in a town like Nashua, there's not a lot of homelessness there. And it kind of like focus on you, it kind of like puts you in the spotlight. Especially if you drink alcohol and stuff.
Michael is a 53-year-old African American. I've been looking for him since I came across his criminal record. Over the last 6 years, he's spent 854 days in jail. His charges all basically come from being homeless and getting drunk. Here's his summer of 2015. Trespass in an apartment building, spend 30 days in jail. Bother restaurant customers, 42 days in jail. Panhandle aggressively, 30 days in jail. There are charges for drinking in public and urinating on buildings. This has been Michael's life for years. Drink, get arrested, go to court, go to jail, repeat. At the courthouse, I watch him plead guilty to public urination. Then we take a walk in the rain through the city.
People kill homeless people, violence and everything else. You know, it can be a very dangerous life to live in. You know, I don't suggest jail as an alternative, but no kind of life, you know what I'm saying?
Doctors around the country are worried about a group of opioid addicts they are describing as the sickest of the sick. They are IV drug users, mostly heroin addicts, who get infections in their hearts. These people are being wheeled into hospitals around the country, including here in New Hampshire. And as Jack Rodolico reports, treating them is creating an ethical dilemma for doctors.
In his late 20s, Christopher Milford got high on some OxyContin his friend gave him. By his early 30s, he was shooting heroin and Suboxone. Milford would reuse the same needle for a week or more. And one day, out of the blue, he was so sick he couldn't get out of bed.
It felt like the worst flu I ever got in my life. Almost felt like a dream. I started doing weird things. Put in PlayStation controllers in the sink, in the bathroom. It was just weird off the wall.
Milford had endocarditis, essentially an abscess on one of his heart valves. He spent 7 weeks in the hospital on IV antibiotics. Then things got worse. He went back home, he kept shooting drugs, and he got endocarditis 2 more times. Milford eventually quit drugs, but after 6 months sober, he was smoking a cigarette one day, and he kept dropping it. A few minutes later, he couldn't talk.
I wrote stroke on a piece of paper, handed it to my mother, and she called the ambulance. I couldn't talk. It was scary. The scariest feeling in the world. And that's why I'm talking like I am.
Milford's stroke wasn't half the damage endocarditis did to him. He would undergo 2 heart surgeries to implant a pacemaker and replace his infected valve. At the time, he was 35 years old.
So this is surgeries for endocarditis that's associated with IV drug use.
Jonathan Ettinger, a cardiologist at Catholic Medical Center in Manchester, didn't treat Christopher Milford, but he's showing me spreadsheets he made to track patients like Milford. Ettinger says IV drug abusers who undergo heart valve replacement surgery...
There's a doctor in New London who's ending her decades-long medical practice on Friday. She's nearly 85, but her retirement is not voluntary. She says she's being forced to shut down by a system that no longer values the type of patient-centered medicine that she practices. But the New Hampshire Board of Medicine has a different take. They're challenging her medical decision-making and other aspects of her work. And HBR's Rita Green reports.
Dr. Anna Konopka's medical office sits just across the driveway from her house. Her black, fluffy dog often waits outside, greeting cars as they drive up. Konopka's place is tucked along the shore of Pleasant Lake in New London. There's no cell service, no Wi-Fi. I spent nearly 5 hours there last week, talking with Konopka and her patients as they filed in and out.
Who's next, please?
Matt Reynolds came in from Claremont on Thursday morning. At 33 years old, he explains he's seen a world of pain. He was attacked about a decade ago on the street, stabbed 18 times, he says. He also has a serious spine disease and shattered his hand in a workplace accident a couple years ago.
Honestly, if it wasn't for Ms. Konopka and the things that she's done to help me get where I am today, then I don't feel that I would be able to support my family.
Before he saw her, he says he visited every major hospital in the Upper Valley without success.
I've seen 30, 40 different professionals, and their answers are all the same. Well, short of surgery, there's nothing we can do.
He says Konopka's instead worked with him intensely, gotten to the root of his interconnected aches and pains, and helped him avoid surgery with different therapies, supplements, and medications. I heard these kinds of stories over and over again. Konopka listens and spends time with you, her patients say. She learns your family history, your physical and mental state. She doesn't just rush you out the door with a prescription.
I'm inside a lab at UNH, where master's student Mia Phillips is about to open up a little plastic container. It looks like it might be leftovers.
So careful, it kind of smells. There we go.
So this is a dead mouse?
Yeah, that's a dead mouse rolled up in a ball by two parent beetles.
Turns out it is leftovers, just not for us. It's for a pair of American burying beetles. Now, these bugs earn their name by working with a mate to bury small dead critters they find lying around. Then they lay their eggs near the carcass, which becomes baby food. And the reason Phillips is tending to a flock of hundreds of these beetles here in the lab is because she's trying to solve a riddle about how they communicate. See, when the beetles are burying a corpse, they seem to be talking. Phillips plays me a recording she made in the lab.
Yeah, so like the obvious question is like, what does that mean? Like, what are they saying?
That's a difficult enough question already. But there's a twist. Burying beetles are deaf. So why would they make a noise that they can't even hear?
Lately, we've been asking you, our listeners, what you want to know about the Granite State. It's part of our Only in New Hampshire series. And today, NHPR's Hannah McCarthy solves the mystery of an abandoned town and the people who vanished from it.
This question comes from listener Sammer, and it's a tricky one.
This is Sammer.
So, Sammer noticed that on the year 2000 U.S. Census, there were three people living in a town called Livermore, New Hampshire. But in the year 2010, they were gone. Sammer figured the residents must have died or moved out or
something where it was consumed within another town.
But one way or another, this place is now a ghost town.
The concept of ghost towns kind of interested me anyway.
So, Sammer's question, what happened to those three residents? I took the case. Natural first step, find Livermore on a map. And I did. It turns out it's in the middle of the White Mountain National Forest, up a long dirt road, narrow in places where the rivers washed it out. There are ruins, bricks crumbling into overgrown foundations, the odd bed frame or bank vault slowly becoming one with the forest.
Oh, cool, there's an old Pepsi can. Totally gonna get tetanus.
According to the records, this town was abandoned about 60 years ago.
The Synchro Sisters come marching into town like they've never seen a cloud in the sky, never felt the sting of rejection. They smile and wave, and the crowd lining the parade route on Main Street smiles and waves back. In their colorful one-piece swimsuits, they offer a hint of the performance to come.
Pretty smoking hot.
Marianne Cullinan is one of the synchros who will perform at the parade's conclusion. She says, do not judge the sisters by their acrobatics. Do not judge them by their harmony. Instead, please just enjoy.
I would say the Synchro Sisters
aren't always synchronized, and we're not always swimming, but we are always a spectacle to behold.
It's time to reveal the synchro secret. They perform in shallow water. Their synchro toes, in fact, are often pressing off of Norway Pond's sandy bottom. Ashley Flamino says calling them synchronized swimmers is, in fact, to misinterpret what these ladies accomplish.
So we do a lot of standing, a lot of twirling. There is some mechanics in the water where we're not actually standing, but it's sort of an illusion.
An illusion worth falling for every time. For the 9th consecutive year, the Synchro Sisters are about to dazzle dozens, possibly hundreds of fans in the pond in the center of this Norman Rockwell town. According to Julie Brown, the bar deserves to be high.
Sometimes we don't practice till June or July, a little too late, but this year we got an early start, so we're feeling prepared.
In the 1950s and 60s, the Ladies of Hancock carried out a similar summer performance. In 2008, Synchro mother Amy Marcus helped renew the tradition, and more recently handed over the reins.
I love that we passed it on to a new generation of women, because those of us that started it were, I don't know, we were in our 40s and 50s and some older than that. And I love that a group of younger women have taken it on and improved it even.
With the parade reaching its conclusion, the 15 sisters put on their swim caps. They huddle up for a last-minute pep talk when, no joke, a bald eagle starts circling.
Do you see it? Right there. That's a good sign.
With that all-American omen overhead, the clock strikes 12:30.
I'd like to introduce the Synchro Sisters. You are a very lucky crowd. They are going to do two numbers, and when they are done with their two numbers, there's going to be a kid's number, so don't leave after the first two numbers.
The opening number is set to a Florence and the Machine song. It starts out slowly, with each sister descending into the dark water. Then a crescendo builds. Arms sway left and right and reach for the sky. Then there's a wave of swan-like motions, flurry kicks, half pikes. Now a group of sisters are forming a circle, with a smaller group of sisters trapped inside of the circle. They anchor into a platform, and there, standing on their shoulders, three more sisters suddenly appear. They spring clear out of the water. The flying sisters look a little panicked, but the crowd loves it.
It's 6 a.m. on Saturday, and 6 degrees outside, and six men sit together in the transfer station in Shelburne, dumping donuts, they call it. And while there are donuts and coffee, and trash has been tossed, all six men are enjoying a breakfast of...
What is this, Ken?
Taco soup.
Taco soup at 6 a.m. at the dump. The men turn from their soup to stare at a security monitor mounted on the wall, and watch as a small car pulls to a stop at the trash compactor. Matt Tassi is the first to guess who it is.
Is that Cosgrove?
Cosgrove.
Yeah, John Cosgrove.
He's a Hillary supporter.
I'd brought my hat if I'd known he was coming.
What's your hat say?
Make America great.
So far, everyone here at Dunkin' Donuts is a Donald Trump supporter. And the minute John Cosgrove steps through the door, he knows he's in the lion's den. But that doesn't stop him.
I have never been as embarrassed about anyone representing this country as this man. He may do the best things in the world, but his treatment of people, I've spent a lifetime as a teacher trying to bring out the best in people, and all I've seen this man do is belittle and intimidate, and I'm ashamed to see he represents my country as a president.
Randy, who wished he'd worn his Trump hat, shrugs.
Well, he's got his opinion. He and I don't see eye to eye.
Well, we respect one another. Hey, listen, we've had huge battles. I've hollered and screamed and walked out of here pissed off. And we come back, and that's the way it is. And that's the way it should be.
Well, with Trump's inauguration just days away, both across the country and here in Shelburne, it's unclear if the way it should be is the way it is. Behind my seat on the counter is a mason jar labeled RG's Canada Relocation Fund. It's stuffed with cash, and Randy tells me why.
You know, when people in the movies or out in Hollywood saying, if Trump wins, I'm leaving the country. Guy here in town said he was leaving. We took up a collection to help him go. And he ain't gone yet either.
Does he know the jars here?
Oh
yeah.
We brought him in to show him.
Everyone's shocked when Dave Hamill comes through the door. Nobody saw him on the dump cam.
My sister is here for her first visit to Dunkin' Donuts. I'm bringing her down to the library now because I wanted to show her the library because she's never seen the library either.
Hamill's sister Lorraine died in December, and Hamill's taking her ashes on a tour of the town. Though no collection was raised for his departure, Hamill's another Shelburneite who planned on leaving.
I said I was moving to Mexico way before Rosie O'Donnell and the rest of them said they were moving.
And even though he didn't vote for Trump and doesn't like him as a person,
I believe that he is arrogant, egotistical, chauvinistic, and definitely a woman basher.
Still, he's come around to the idea of Trump as president.
As I view what he is doing with the patriotism that we are so desiring to re-achieve, I have to take my hat off to him because he's doing things like nobody else ever has.
In the 3 hours I'm at the dump, only one woman comes through the door, Sally Manikian.
Yeah, I came here to drop off my trash and then we're going to go hit the trails.
A competitive dog sledder, Manikian says she voted for Hillary Clinton and still hasn't gotten over her defeat.
It's just so strange. It's so surreal. I have fairly strong mental blinders, and I think they went up about a week ago.
I walk outside with her to see her sled dogs.
Hey, Wembley.
Winter is here, and Trump is coming. Sally Manikian gets in her truck, off for a 30-mile mush in the woods. I wave to Dave Hamill as he passes, heading off with his sister to show her the town he loves. For NHPR, I'm Sean Hurley.
This fall, the U.S. Supreme Court will hear arguments in a controversial free speech case out of Colorado, where a baker refused to make a wedding cake for a same-sex couple. And the baker's attorneys say they're resting their arguments on a precedent set decades ago in New Hampshire. As part of our State of Democracy project, NHPR's Lauren Chulgin tells the story of one determined New Hampshire couple and how their battle with the state's famous motto continues to have an impact.
Live free or die for many New Hampshire people is just part of the culture of living here. It's on t-shirts, it's a good New Hampshire joke punchline, it's constantly quoted in political speeches. But even though we may hear it all the time, most of us don't really think too much about it. But George and Maxine Maynard are different.
It's Lauren.
Yeah, it is. No, it's afternoon, no.
No, I said it's Lauren.
The Maynards have what you might call a complicated relationship with Live Free or Die. They're in their mid-80s now. They shuffle around their one-story home in Connecticut, where they keep tabs on their neighbors and read the Bible every day. The Maynards are deeply religious.
Okay, Daniel, D-A-N.
Take George's email address, for example. It's Daniel_2_44, a Bible verse he will happily explain to you.
As God's promised, he's going to crush all the governments of the world, and his government is going to rule by his son, Jesus Christ. So that's my email.
And the Maynards' faith is central to this story and their relationship to Live Free or Die. George calls himself a Jehovah's Witness, even though he was kicked out or disfellowshipped in 1966. I couldn't confirm why this happened. George says some other witnesses didn't like him, so they falsely accused him of defrauding other members. Whatever happened, George hasn't been allowed in a Kingdom Hall since, but not for lack of trying.
When we moved up to New Hampshire, here again, I tried to attend meetings, and they wouldn't let me. So they would treat me like a leper.
So here you had George Maynard, deeply religious, disfellowshipped, feeling like he didn't have the right to practice his own religion. And he was moving to New Hampshire, a state with Live Free or Die on its license plates. The motto didn't stand a chance.
I wasn't free.
To the Maynards, having Live Free or Die stuck on their car was like advertising a way of life they didn't subscribe to. They didn't feel free, and they believe God will grant them everlasting life. So George covered up the motto with a strip of red electrical tape. And with that bit of tape, battle lines were drawn between the Maynards and the state of New Hampshire. The first encounter took place in a Lebanon parking lot in 1974.
We were shopping one night, and the police officer came to me and says, I have to give you a citation because you're covering up the motto. I says, well, it's been a long time. I've been waiting for you.
New Hampshire law prohibited residents from altering their state plates, so George was fined $25. A judge later suspended it, pending good behavior. But George didn't remove the tape. He went a step further.
It wasn't too long after that, the same officer stopped me again.
Neil Woolley was the Lebanon police chief back then.
Only this time they'd taken a pair of cutting shears or something and physically cut the words right out of the plate.
George ended up getting 3 tickets.
But when the laws of man conflict with God's...
He recorded himself fighting those tickets in district court. And listening to this cassette tape, it's clear that even all these years later, George's passion against the motto has not changed. When he played it for me, he mouthed the words along with his younger self, as if the arguments were imprinted in his brain.
Live free or die is against my teaching and my belief, because...
Richard Spalding is in no mood.
You know any good bagpipe jokes?
No.
A retired state policeman, Spalding is too busy managing a bagpipe empire. The company's name is Gibson Bagpipes. It is the largest bagpipe maker in North America, 4th largest in the world, and after launching decades ago in Ohio, it now calls Nashua, New Hampshire home. Their baseline set of pipes start at about $1,400. On the manufacturing floor, 3 workers are filling the day's orders. Master craftsmen are standing at lathes, while another applies a lacquer finish.
Everything's done by hand.
The distinct bagpipe sound comes from air being blown through what are called drones, the pipes that point over the shoulder. Gibson and most pipe makers turn these parts out of something called African blackwood. It is a gorgeous dark color and rock hard.
This is the African blackwood.
Whoa.
Dense.
Very dense. And that's why it resonates the sound, and that's why bagpipes have been made out of these for hundreds of years.
African blackwood, though, is under environmental stress. Last year, an international consortium that monitors the trade of animal and plant products, it moved African blackwood, along with another bagpipe staple, cocobolo, to a higher risk level. The woods aren't threatened with extinction just yet, but as of earlier this year, if you want to move this wood across international borders, you need a permit. So last December, 11 months ago, Gibson started its application process with the federal government.
Had to fill out all that paperwork with a check for the permits, mailed it down. They said they never got it.
Got lost in the mail.
I can't remember a day without soccer, to be quite honest.
Jared Barbosa is an elementary school guidance counselor, but he was raised by a pro soccer player, a Brazilian who competed all over the world before settling here in Nashua. Every Sunday, Barbosa comes here to the Dunstable soccer fields to play in an adult soccer league. 150 or so mostly Latino guys compete on different teams. They've been coming for years.
It's an eventful Sunday here when the adult league is playing because there's kids all over, there's family, there's food, there's music.
It was here, on one of these Sundays, he began to realize something was wrong. Kids were kicking soccer balls on the sidelines. Later, he'd see them dribbling in the street or doing tricks on basketball courts.
And seeing the level, the ability, the good players.
The problem was they weren't playing on organized teams. Barbosa and his brother, a college-level soccer coach, started asking around.
Well, it's too expensive.
Nelly Sidasso is just one of many parents whose kids were priced out of Nashua's club soccer scene. She grew up in Mexico and moved to Nashua 10 years ago. Her 2 kids are serious about soccer. They played for a while on the local rec team, but it was too informal. So she looked at the local club teams. But they run from $800 to $1,500 per kid per year, not including uniforms. Some offer financial aid, but the price tag itself can be a barrier. Today, Sidasso's kids play for a competitive club team run by the Barbosas. Sidasso watches her kids from the sidelines and banters with other parents.
I love the coach because he's strict, but he's nice, he's firm with the kids, and I think the kids, they need that.
This club costs $100 a year per kid. Siblings are half off, uniforms are included. The league has 5 teams, and last year, 2 of them won the state championships. The Latin and Hispanic International Football Association, or LIFA as it's called, consists mostly of boys and men of color. But anyone can join, any skill level, race, gender, income, ability to...
This is Morning Edition from NHPR. The heightened public awareness around sexual harassment in Hollywood, the media, and national politics has started to trickle down to the local level, including state legislatures. While New Hampshire has not seen the kind of high-profile cases that have started to appear in other state capitals, NHPR reporter Casey McDermott talked to many people who work around the Statehouse who say harassment is a day-to-day problem. And she joins us now to talk more about that reporting. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning, Rick.
So what made you decide to look into this, Casey?
So obviously there's been kind of a groundswell of public conversation around sexual harassment and specifically sexual harassment as it relates to people's workplaces. We've seen this kind of burgeoning Me Too movement of people speaking up about their experiences in lots of professions, including politics. And I can say just anecdotally, you know, I've been in New Hampshire for about 3 years working around the State House. I've heard a number of just, you know, casual stories from people about their own kind of uncomfortable interactions mm-hmm. that they've had in that setting. Obviously, that on its own is not enough for a story, but I figured that there was enough there to at least start asking people more broadly, can you tell me a little bit about your experiences?
So what did you find out when you started digging?
So as part of my reporting, as you would expect, I asked the House and the Senate for any records that they had related to sexual harassment. And what I found was that there are incidents that are reported. Now, the House turned over a number of records. There have been about 10 incidents that have risen to the level of, you know, an actual complaint or something that would be documented over the last 2 years. Incidents that kind of spanned a broad spectrum of different types of harassment in the House, most of which, again, were dealt with informally, documented in case they escalated in the future. Now, the Senate was significantly less responsive in terms of turning over documents. The paper trail they did provide raised some additional questions that are worth looking into further, though. They held back a number of documents citing attorney-client privilege and personnel exemptions, but the records they did provide showed that the Senate paid more than $4,000 to a law firm that specializes in sexual harassment complaints for services that were utilized in 2013 and 2014. But the Senate wouldn't say what those services were.
New Hampshire's transportation network may get a makeover this year with strong support for infrastructure spending from both Governor Sununu and President Trump. And many say the attention's needed, with the State Department of Transportation rating about a third of our roads in poor or very poor condition. Also, more than 150 state bridges are on the scary-sounding red list, along with more than 350 local bridges. And so today in The Exchange, we take a tour of New Hampshire's transportation infrastructure, where the pavement's smooth and where the potholes are. It's part of our effort here at NHPR and NPR to focus on policies of the first 100 days of the State House and the White House. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have two guests for the hour. Logan Johnson is here. She's a civil engineer who serves on the board of directors of the New Hampshire chapter of the American Society of Civil Engineers. And Logan, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Victoria Sheehan, commissioner of the New Hampshire Department of Transportation. Before that, she served at the Massachusetts Department of Transportation. And Commissioner Sheehan, this is the first time we've talked. It's good to have you too.
Thank you, Laura. It's a pleasure to be here.
So both of you, here we are at this political moment where the governor and the president both say infrastructure needs a lot more attention. Let's hear Governor Sununu talking about this.
Who is the current Speaker of the House?
Oh, the guy that cries, and I don't know his name.
29% of those Americans that were asked could not name the vice president.
Don't even know.
Donald Trump today unveiled his choice for press secretary.
Reince Priebus will serve as Trump's chief of staff.
Congressional redistricting.
Separation of powers.
Shall appoint ambassadors.
The filibuster.
Foundation.
Judges of the Supreme Court.
Civics 101.
I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Civics 101, the podcast that teaches you things you should have learned or maybe forgot from your high school U.S. history and government classes. We thought the first 100 days of the Trump administration the perfect time for a little refresher. Each week, we'll answer one question, like how do vetoes work? What does a White House press secretary do? Or what is gerrymandering? Today, the role of the chief of staff, and Professor Charles Wolcott is our guide. He's professor emeritus of political science at Virginia Tech. For the past two decades, his research has focused on understanding the structural evolution and workings of the executive office. Professor Wolcott, welcome to Civics 101.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So there is nothing mandated in the Constitution for this position. When did White House Chief of Staff become a position?
It really became a position in the modern sense.
Generally, I have a great job, but there are some pitfalls. When you cover environmental issues in the state of New Hampshire, there's a conversation that is just inevitable. It happens with people I've just met. It happens with my most dear friends.
We're gathered to show our opposition to a project that is not necessary.
Eventually, people want to know what I think of the Northern Pass.
When I first learned about the Northern Pass, I was astounded.
I've been covering Northern Pass for 6 years. I've filed dozens of stories on it, done a three-part radio series about it. I talk on talk shows about it. It's a very big, very divisive issue in New Hampshire. People have bumper stickers on their cars and signs in their front yards about it. I mean, it even came up in a Republican primary debate.
Mr. Trump, you have said, quote, I love eminent domain.
The Northern Pass is a proposed piece of infrastructure. It's a power line, 240 miles long, that would stretch from southern Quebec to southern New Hampshire.
Here in New Hampshire, a project, though, known as the Northern Pass, would bring hydroelectric power from Canada into the northeastern grid. Do you see eminent domain as an appropriate tool to get that project done?
Well, let me just tell you about eminent domain, because almost all of these people...
Much of the proposed route will actually be buried along state roads or runs along existing smaller power lines, but a portion of it does not. And it's this new route, which would require the building of towers, mostly around 80 or 90 feet tall, and some as tall as 165 feet, and the path itself, which would cut through New Hampshire's northern forests, that has people worked up.
Northern Pass will ruin the natural beauty and cultural heritage of New Hampshire.
The power that would come down this line is from big hydroelectric facilities. Rivers that have been dammed and diverted and are now being run through turbines. It's being pitched as clean, renewable energy. Energy to replace all of the fossil fuel and nuclear power plants that are retiring all over New England. So people are split down the middle on it. The last poll on the Northern Pass project is a little old at this point, 2 years, but it found that 39% of people were opposed to it, 35% were in favor, and 25% didn't have an opinion. And so when this happens, when a friend or an acquaintance or a family member asks me about the Northern Pass, I want to run. It is a total minefield.
Governor Sununu, do the right thing. I know that you're supporting Northern Pass. Do the right thing.
But the debate, down here at least, has mostly been about the power line itself. The dams, the source of the electricity, are so far away. It's like they're not even real to the people here in New Hampshire. They're symbols on a map. They're pieces on a chessboard. And talking about this project, talking about the power line without talking about the electrons that would flow inside of it, it's a little bit like debating train tracks without ever talking about trains. Or having an argument about what's the best kind of sandwich without ever discussing what's inside. And let's just say, there's a lot inside.
It's a big discrimination in Quebec against the First Nation. We know that. We live here. We feel it just by the way they look at us, you know. We feel it.
We're not perfect, but we are working with the people, and we want to work with them. So I hope, with all the rest of the message, I hope you give this one.
And that was bad back then. That was really bad, because all we did was fight, and we were really good at fighting.
They tried to make a sweet deal with the Innus to buy their rights for basically nothing. It was unconstitutional, illegal, totally illegal.
This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown.
And I'm Hannah McCarthy.
For months, we have been working on this story.
We're calling it Powerline, a four-part series about who has power, who wields it, and when you've got none, how do you take it?
In this first episode, we're going back to the beginning. Where did this project come from, and where does it go?
What we found is that hydropower in Quebec is tied to a deep political history, one that stretches back decades and is inextricably tied with the reimagination of the French-Canadian identity.
And over the next few weeks, we'll tell you that history and how it continues to echo into the events of today, both north and south of the border.
Good morning, it's 7:04. This is NHPR News. I'm Rick Ganley. The Executive Council approved contracts with 10 separate reproductive health providers and community health centers Wednesday. As NHPR's Casey McDermott reports, the scene echoed past battles over family planning funding.
Planned Parenthood supporters lined the state house hallways, urging counselors to keep the funding going. Republican counselor David Wheeler grilled state officials over what kind of services the providers offered before voting no on all 10 items. But in the end, after hours of discussion, each contract passed. And as in past votes, one Republican, Executive Counselor Russ Prescott, joined with the council's two Democrats to approve the $2.9 million in funding, including for Planned Parenthood. Prescott said he tried to ignore the politics around the vote.
I didn't let it cloud my judgment of what position of government I'm in and my duties to carry out that role.
Some of the money is retroactive to cover providers that have been operating without a contract for the last few months. For NHPR News, I'm Casey McDermott.
A federal agency is confirming what many New Englanders already suspected. October was the warmest on record in Vermont, New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island. Second warmest in Maine. The nationwide statistics were released Wednesday by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. It'll be a distant memory by tomorrow, with below-average temperatures expected and even some snow across northern New England tonight. Voters in Keene rejected the lottery game Keno Tuesday by a nearly 2-1 margin. The state legislature legalized the game this year, tying its revenue to funding for all-day kindergarten. But cities don't have to allow Keno locally to get the funding. NHPR's Rita Green has more.
The message from residents was clear. Keno is not welcome in Keene. City Councilor Mitch Greenwald says kindergarten shouldn't be tied to gambling. He says the state has the responsibility to fund education plain and simple.
If this is some little backwards way that they're throwing some pennies into our educational budget, I'll take the money. They should be doing a heck of a lot more.
Voters also rejected Keno Tuesday in Concord and Dover. In Portsmouth, the issue didn't even make it to the ballot. But Keno saw success in other areas of the state. It won approval in 7 cities, including Manchester, Nashua, Berlin, and Claremont. For NHPR News, I'm Brita Green.
In sports, the Celtics beat the Lakers 107-96 for their 10th straight win. The Rangers beat the Bruins, though, 4-2. Well, some thick fog this morning. Could be some areas of black ice as well. It'll be partly to mostly sunny otherwise, with highs in the 40s this afternoon. Maybe a scattered snow shower tonight, particularly to the north, lows in the 20s. Sun but cold tomorrow. It'll be windy with highs only in the 20s and 30s. This is NHPR News. It's 7:07. Good morning.